I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. The Affordable Care Act's new health insurance exchanges, where consumers can shop and enroll for coverage, open tomorrow. The goal is to get more of the uninsured into the system, and that's about 15% of the population. The federal government is offering subsidies to help low-income individuals and families get coverage. Prices will vary from state to state. While the ACA was passed more than 3 years ago, there is still a lot of confusion and misinformation about what's in and what's out and what it will cost. The showdown between the House and the Senate over implementation is not making anything clearer. A brand new Kaiser Health tracking poll found that 51% of the public and 67% of the uninsured say they need more information about the law to know how it will affect them. And that's our topic for today's Radio Times. And let me introduce our two guests. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is Robert Field. He's a professor of law and professor of health management and policy at the Earl Mack School of Law and School of Public Health at Drexel University, author of a forthcoming book called Mother of Invention, How the Government Created Free Market Healthcare. And Robert Field, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Happy to be here.
And also with us and joining us from the Kaiser Family Foundation studios in Washington, D.C. is Julie Appleby. She's a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and Kaiser Health News is an editorially independent program of the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation, and it is not affiliated with Kaiser Permanente. And Julie Appleby, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
I was reading your poll over the weekend, and clearly a lot of confusion, especially among the uninsured, and so much of these exchanges are aimed at the uninsured. Why do you think this confusion continues when it comes to the Affordable Care Act?
There's been confusion, I think, ever since the law was passed. It's probably not getting any better, partly because people keep hearing reports that maybe the law's been defunded, maybe it's been repealed, maybe it's been this, maybe it's been that. So I think there's a lot of confusion about whether it even exists. Other polls have shown, for example, that something like 42% of people think the law has been repealed. The poll that's out today from the Kaiser Family Foundation does show that among the uninsured, 3 out of every 4 don't know that these new marketplaces are supposed to open. And that's got to be a concern for the proponents of the law, because those are the folks that they're really aiming these marketplaces at.
Robert Field, you've been on the show several times talking about this, and I feel like I always put the same question to you as well, which is why this continued confusion and misunderstanding about the Affordable Care Act?
Well, we continue to have the same problem, which is the administration is so clumsy about communicating it. This is an incredibly complicated act, but you can distill it to its essence. If it were up to me, I would call it the guaranteed coverage law. Guaranteed is clear, it's strong, it says what the guts of this is about. When they start getting into the steps, the exchanges, the subsidies, and so forth, it's easy to lose people who are not policy wonks. Look at what the opponents have done. They've crafted these two-word epithets, government takeover, socialized medicine, costly program. That gets to the essence of their message. They don't give you all the details behind it. They give you the essence, and the Obama people, for some reason, haven't done that.
Well, let me pick up on that, Julie, and go back to you, because part of the polling that you've done is to look at what people misunderstand about the Affordable Care Act. One is that it is government-run. This is not a government-run program. Can you speak to some of this misinformation?
Well, the polling has been done by the foundation and some other groups, and I think that folks really are confused about whether it's government-run or not, that type of thing. That some of the questions that came out in the most recent poll found that people are just curious about, you know, will this medical insurance be free, or will I have to pay for it? Can you just put it in plain language so we can understand it? What happens if we're unable to afford it? I've heard we can go to jail. There's a lot of stuff online that is very confusing for folks. They're maybe Googling things or getting misinformation. It's a complicated law. I mean, there's all kinds of things out there. I'm hearing a lot from readers and viewers who call me up, and they're really curious about, hey, I have Medicare. Do I need to sign up for this? The answer is no. You have Medicare. You're covered. If you have job-based insurance, generally you're not going to go to these marketplaces. So that's another question I get a lot of here is, what happens if I have coverage at my job? Am I going to go to these marketplaces? What's going to happen? I think there's just a lot of questions out there. There's a real hunger people have to understand this at the moment.
But do you, like Robert Field, do you hold the White House responsible for this?
Well, you know, I can't say, you know, I'm a reporter, so right. I'm really not saying who's responsible for it, but I think that the messaging has been confusing. The messaging has been complicated. They've stepped up to the plate only fairly recently to really start pushing what's going on with this law. The president has been very forceful in the last week talking about this law. He was on the television on Saturday and I think fairly succinctly summarized how this law affects folks. But that's a recent development. Mm-hmm. Now, some of the states and some of the others who are starting their advertising campaigns have already gotten going, but many of them tell me that they're waiting until October 1st because that's when people are really going to start paying attention. So a lot of them have held off on their messaging, but I think we're going to start hearing a lot more of it now.
But do you think, Robert, that it is easier to either criticize or maybe even misinform or to call it a government-run program, even though it's not, but those are, you know, words you could put on a bumper sticker?
It is easier. It's always easier to destroy something than to build something. So the administration does face an uphill battle, but they have not really taken on the challenge to the extent they can. Now, to be fair, before the exchanges are actually open, it's hard to really explain them and tell people, but you can't go there yet.
Right.
Just wait. You know, we're telling you about it now. It's a few weeks off. I think after tomorrow, it will be easier to say, this is what it is. If you want to find out more today, you can go to this website, call this toll-free number.
I've often wondered whether if you were to ask the public before the Affordable Care Act, and this would be going back obviously 3.5 mm-hmm. years, to explain and describe our health care system, would they be able to do that, Robert Field?
No one can explain our health care system.
It's so convoluted, right?
I teach courses on our health care system, and I feel like I barely touch the tip of the iceberg. And that's one of the problems that the Obama people have in addition, is health care is so complicated, insurance is so complicated, you put the two together and you have a perfect storm. So they have to distill that message down to something that people can understand. Mm. How many people understand their health insurance policy? I think the people at the insurance companies who write them don't understand them fully. So to ask people to understand all those issues, all those details, is going a little bit too far. But you can still get them to say, you'll have coverage, this is what it'll cost, sign here.
Well, and Julie, some of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act are already in place, having to do with pre-existing conditions and children, adult children covered under their parents' plan if they don't, you know, if they can't get that through their work or they're not employed. So there are parts of the Affordable Care Act that are already in place.
That's correct. So you can keep your child on your plan until age 26. That's already in place. The pre-existing conditions provision mainly goes into effect January 1st, and that's for folks who are buying insurance. They can no longer be rejected if they have a medical condition. There has been a provision in effect for children, but for everybody else, it's going into effect January 1st. There's been some other changes as well, so I don't know if you noticed, if you went to the doctor this year, you may have gotten a mammogram or some other kind of cancer screening without a copay. Some of that's in effect. And there's also a rule requiring insurers to spend at least 80% of their revenue on medical care, or they have to pay a rebate. So that's been in effect for a while. But the major provisions, the big changes for many people, especially those who buy their own insurance, start January 1st.
I had one of those procedures done just earlier this or last week, Robert. And I think sometimes we forget when you can walk out of the doctor's office and you're not writing them a check or giving them cash, this was covered under the current healthcare system.
This is a specific these were covered,
right.
But now they're covered without a copay or deductible. Right. And the theory was that if you get people to have preventive care, they won't get sick later and will be saving costs for the overall system. I wonder how many people who've gotten these preventive services understand that they didn't pay the copay right. because of the health reform law.
And they probably don't, right?
Probably most people do not. It's just one of those billing quirks. And in fact, a lot of doctors still are charging the copays because they don't understand the system themselves.
Oh, the doctors don't.
Yeah. At times, I've had the experience of having to go back to the insurance company and get a refund for a copay because the systems weren't set up. So it's complicated like everything else. But again, the message is not out there that you got your mammogram, you got your screening for cancer free because of this law.
Julie, let me go back to you. And when we talk about these exchanges going into effect starting tomorrow, we're really talking about, what, about something like 15 to 16% of the population that is part of these exchanges?
Well, right now, about 15 million people buy their own insurance, generally because they don't get it through their jobs. So we're talking about those folks. The market's for them. The market's also for the uninsured, and there's about 48 million of those folks. Now, some of them are going to qualify for an expanded program called Medicaid. Some of them live in states where the states have decided not to expand that. But mainly, this is for those people who don't get coverage through their jobs, and they want to buy it on their own. Right now, there's about 15 million. The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that in the first year, about 7 million people are expected to enroll through these exchanges. Now, the big question is, will 7 million actually enroll or not? But that's what they're expecting. And of those, the vast majority are expected to qualify for some kind of a subsidy to help them purchase that coverage.
In fact, I think reading some of the reporting from Kaiser and some of the polling there, about half of the uninsured will pay less than $100 a month per person per month. Did I read that right, Julie?
I've seen some numbers. I think Kathleen Sebelius has been saying that about 6 out of 10 young people may pay less than $100 a month with subsidies. There are a number of places where people will pay very small amounts. And remember, it's based on your income.
Right.
So people are going to pay a certain percentage of their income toward the premium, and then the premium is going to, the government will pick up the rest of the premium for those folks who are getting a subsidy. And that percentage of your income ranges from as little as 2% to as much as 9.5%. So it really varies. On the higher end of the sliding scale, people are going to be spending up to 9.5% of their income before that premium kicks in.
And what we see, Robert, is some pretty dramatic variability when you look from state to state.
Yeah, well, last week the administration released some preliminary data on what the plans are going to cost in different states for the federally run exchanges.
Right.
And it varies a lot between states. It varies within states. For instance, Philadelphia, not surprisingly, is going to be a lot more expensive than Pittsburgh. It's interesting that the factor that seems to be most important in determining that is the amount of competition between plans. Philadelphia actually is going to have fewer different plans than most other big cities, which may be one reason it's going to be more expensive here. But that's the way the law was intended to work. It was intended to harness competition to create a marketplace where the free market would do its magic and bring down costs. So it seems like on first glance that is actually happening.
Hmm.
As the program progresses, the hope is that there will be more plans participating and that will bring down rates even further.
Because maybe there would be competition between, like one state would look at people in one state would look at another state saying, well, why are they paying, you know, so much less than we're paying this state?
Or the way markets tend to work, that insurance companies will look at a market that doesn't have much competition, say, here's an opportunity to get some profits. They will move in, and over time it balances itself mm-hmm. out. So you start to get more of an even distribution of premiums.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. We're talking about the Affordable Care Act's health insurance exchanges. They are scheduled to open tomorrow. And talking with Robert Field and Julie Appleby. And we're taking calls as well. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Just about all the polling is telling us that there is confusion and misinformation about how the system is supposed to work. And that's why we're here. So give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Keystone Clinical Studies of Norristown is conducting a clinical research trial for adults who suffer from major depressive disorder. If you are between 18 and 65 suffering from major depressive disorder, and if your current medication is not working, you may be eligible to participate in this clinical research trial. Participants will receive investigational drug and study-related evaluations. 610-277-8073, 610-277-8073, or KeystoneClinicalStudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, the AMC series Breaking Bad comes to a close.
Jesse, you asked me if I was in the meth business or the money business. Neither. I'm in the empire business.
We'll recap the finale. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Fabric Workshop and Museum presents a talk by artist-in-residence Mario Ibarra Jr. and reception on First Friday, October 4th, 6 to 8 p.m. Exhibitions on view during the October 4th reception include Mario Ibarra Jr., Books of Drawings, Beyond Our Dreams, Blame Our Dads, Brains on Drugs, Better Off Dead, and A Riot of Color, the Fabric Workshop and Museum in collaboration with Ruth Fine. Online at fabricworkshopandmuseum.org or 215-561-8888.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Julie Appleby, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and with Robert Field, professor of law and professor of health management and policy at the Earl Mack School of Law and School of Public Health at Drexel University here in Philadelphia. We're talking about the Affordable Care Act's health insurance exchanges. They are opening tomorrow. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Robert, you wanted to say something, just sort of underscoring what Julie said about who it is that we're actually talking about here.
Yeah. You think that the day of doom is fast approaching and everyone's going to somehow see their health care change at midnight tonight. That's not the way this works. This is geared towards a very narrow slice of the population, which is people who haven't been able to get in health insurance because they don't have an employer or a government program and because they can't get an individual policy because they have a pre-existing condition or it's unaffordable. So it's really just them. And that is total, about 5% of the population. When you put the people who've been buying individual coverage in with them, it's about 15% of the population. But this is really all about can't get insurance now, now you can. And it's not about people who get coverage through an employer. It's not about people who get Medicare, Medicaid, or any other government program.
Which is why you want to call it the guaranteed system as opposed to the
exactly.
opposed to the affordable care system.
Exactly. Now, affordable is a relative term.
Right.
It will become much more affordable, as Julie was saying, for poorer people who now get these subsidies. For some people, it actually would be less affordable because they will be the healthy ones who will see their rates go up to balance out the sicker ones. But guaranteed, that's a clear message, and that's the guts of this law.
Julie, let me go back to you, and it seems that part of the system is to try to get young and healthy people into the system. They don't cost so much, and they help. This is the way insurance works, which is it helps kind of spread the cost around.
That's correct. They really are hoping that a lot of younger and healthier people sign up. They're expecting, like I said, the CBO expects about 7 million people in total the first year. And of those, they're hoping somewhere close to 3 million of them will be young and healthy people. So they are really pushing that, trying to encourage folks to sign up. Many of the younger folks are expected to be eligible for subsidies, so that may bring their price down. So they're really hoping that works out. Right. But if it doesn't work out, if young people don't sign up over time, we could see a situation where premiums start to spiral, because if you just get the older and the sicker folks in, you don't have that balancing out, then over time those insurance rates could go up, which could be very problematic for proponents of the law.
Sure. And I know if you don't sign up, and there is a little penalty, it's not a lot of money, it's certainly to begin with, but I guess the idea is to, what, Julie, over time increase the penalty for not signing up?
Yeah, the penalty starts out pretty low. It's $95 or 1% of income in the first year. And I believe it goes up, and Robert, you may have to back me up on this. I think it's 695 or up to 2.5% of your income in time.
And the idea is and I guess, this is the way that insurance works, whether people like it or not.
Sorry, go ahead, Julie.
Go ahead, Julie.
Well, it's kind of like you buy fire insurance for your house, right? Mm-hmm. You don't really expect your house to burn down, but it might one year. But all the other people whose houses didn't burn down that year are basically helping pay your premium and helping pay the cost of rebuilding your house.
And Robert, is the idea that over time, and maybe not for 10 years or so, that this will bring down the total cost of our healthcare system, which obviously eats up so much of the economy?
That's a question.
Do we know the answer to that?
We don't know the answer to that. There's one line of thinking that it might make it worse, because you'll have more people using healthcare services. So you'll have more demand, and the market will then raise prices. It may mitigate that increase because we'll have more preventive care, more people able to see the doctor along the way before they get really sick. There are other aspects of the law that are trying to bring down costs marginally, but it won't necessarily bring down costs.
But it seems to me for some people that use the emergency room like their doctor's office, I mean, and if you can get people to go to the doctor's office and not the ER, aren't you going to save money?
That is one of the theories, that people now go to the emergency room because hospitals have to see them, and then the hospital writes off the bill, and it's essentially free care. It's not clear how many people will shift from the emergency room to the doctor's office. There are studies showing that a lot of people actually like the emergency room. Even though they're sitting there waiting 5 hours for a sore throat, they like being in a major medical facility. So it's not completely clear how much that will succeed, but that is one of the hopes of the law.
Julie, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, they're also hoping that the competition will pick up, not only between insurers, but they're hoping that hospitals are going to be more likely to compete on price and that that over time may also slow spending on health care.
Yeah,
there's
ahead,
another
Mike.
Aspect of that competition is that whether or not we have health reform, we're seeing deductibles go up dramatically. We've been seeing that for 10 years now, so that you can buy a policy on an exchange that has as much as a $6,000 deductible, but a lot of employment policies are now $1,000, $2,000. So people are exposed to a lot of that actual cost, and we're beginning to see some real price competition.
Really?
There are a number of websites that are listing actual costs of a chest x-ray, a checkup, a joint replacement, where you can click on a map and actually see what this doctor will charge, what that doctor will charge. And that's kind of exciting because that has some real potential.
And the idea that you could, in a sense, if not shop around, certainly comparison shop, and maybe even go into your doctor's office and say, why are you charging me X, Y, and Z?
Right. So people have been going in now with their printouts from Medscape saying, this is the condition I think I have. Now they can get the printout and say, this is what the guy down the block is charging for the exact same service. Can you match it?
Julie, let me go back to you. And again, some really basic questions about the exchanges. And we're talking about, I guess, four levels of health insurance. There's the bronze, the silver, the gold, and the platinum. Without getting too lost in the details, is it just a matter of different deductibles and different copays for these various plans?
In general, that's the case. So the bronze and silver plans are going to have higher deductibles and copayments than the gold and silver, and then the gold and the platinum plans, which will have lower ones. You're going to be on the hook for a little bit less with those plans, but you'll be paying more in premium. So that's basically the difference between them. And then what consumers are going to need to do is when they go on these online sites, they're going to need to look at these various plans, see what carriers are offering them, and then maybe even dig a little deeper into what are the doctors and hospitals that are included in these plans. Mm-hmm. Because many of the plans that are expected to be lower in cost in terms of the premiums may have smaller networks of doctors and hospitals. So consumers, advocates are telling me that people really need to check and see if the doctor they want, the hospital they want, et cetera, is included in that particular insurer's network.
And Robert, is that any different from the way we've run our healthcare system? I mean, to have these various options and copays and deductibles?
No, it really isn't. People who use the exchanges will have more options. If you get coverage through an employer, you may only have one or two or at most three different options to choose from, and you'll see those charts of what's covered and what the network is. Here, you're going to see dozens of different options and different price levels, but it's really the same old mechanism. It's the same old health insurance approach to doing things.
And that was the idea, was it not, of the Affordable Care Act, which was essentially to keep the system that we have?
Yeah, and the problem it faces is the system we have is so complicated. So if you're going to reform health care and guarantee coverage to everyone, one approach is you could have a government program, a Medicare for All type program. The other is you could use the private system that we have now. Now, there are pluses and minuses to both, but one thing is undeniable. Our present system is incredibly complicated, and if you're going to stick with it, you're going to have a complicated program.
Julie, I'm curious about those people who are critics of the Affordable Care Act, whether some of those critics basically say, look, we should have Medicare for All or some kind of single-payer system.
I think if you look at some of the polling, the public has generally been split about half and half in favor of the law or opposed to law. And then if you dig into some of the reasons why they are opposed to the law, some people think it went too far. And some people, as you mentioned, didn't think it went far enough. They would rather have seen some kind of a single payer system. So there's a real split even within the people who oppose the law.
I also notice in some of the polling from Kaiser that the public says that the media has not been particularly helpful in helping them understand the Affordable Care Act. You want to expand on that, Julie?
I think I saw those same numbers, yes. And it was a little disheartening. Something like 56% didn't have any trusted news source that they would turn to for information on this. And then of those that did, there was a split between cable news and other media outlets. There's a lot of misinformation out there. There's a lot of things people are hearing, and not all of it is correct.
One thing about the polls that you have to bear in mind is it's now about 50% of the population says they don't understand the law, and about 50% of the population says they don't like the law. So they're saying they don't like something that they don't understand. Clearly something isn't fitting here. And I think it shows how much the communication is important.
There's also a split on the what they don't like. A lot of people really like elements of the law, like the idea that insurers can't reject people with pre-existing conditions, but they really don't like the individual mandate or the penalty for not having coverage. So there's also a split when the pollsters ask about specific elements of the law.
What's interesting, and not to get too political here, but Julie, what's interesting about the mandate is that was actually, I believe it was back in the 1990s, an idea that came out of it was a conservative idea in the 1990s that is now obviously one of the centerpieces of the Affordable Care Act.
That's correct. The idea that, you know, people would be more responsible if they had some skin in the game, if they needed this personal responsibility. That is correct.
In my book, Mother of Invention, yes. I trace that as part of the way the government helped to build up our free market health care. It actually starts with Richard Nixon. In 1973, he entertained this as a free market alternative to Medicare for All, which Ted Kennedy and others were pushing at the time. If it hadn't been for Watergate, that might have gone into effect, and we'd have Nixon care today. It was then revived by Heritage in the late 80s. It became a Republican proposal in 1993 to counteract the Clinton plan. And then, of course, it was adopted in 2006 by Mitt Romney for Massachusetts.
Julie, Robert and I were talking before the show began about this Obamacare, which I noticed the president uses that as well. Do you think, especially for people that don't like the president and don't like this system, that Obamacare is a name that actually hurts the Affordable Care Act?
That's what the polls seem to show, that people don't like Obamacare, but they have a little bit warmer feeling toward the Affordable Care Act. One of my colleagues had a story in the Post today, and he was down in Kentucky working on a story, and the consumer sisters down there, the folks who are going to help people sign up, are telling themselves, don't call it Obamacare, because that'll immediately turn people off if they don't like Obama. They will just not hear anything else you say. And they also say the Affordable Care Act makes people's eyes glaze over. So call it something else. Talk about, hey, do you need health insurance? Here's a way to get connected with health insurance. So that's what he's reporting out of Kentucky, that some of these consumer sisters are going to be talking with folks about.
It matters what something is called, right, Robert Fields?
It matters a lot what something is called. And, of course, they have a roadmap to this. In Massachusetts, they did a brilliant publicity campaign, got people to understand the law and to sign up. They were very aggressive. They had kiosks at Fenway Park where you could buy your coverage through the Massachusetts Exchange. And I don't see anything yet as aggressive as that.
And that's Robert Field. He's a professor of law and professor of health management and policy at the Earl Mack School of Law and School of Public Health at Drexel University here in Philadelphia. Mentioned his forthcoming book called Mother of Invention, How the Government Created Free Market Healthcare. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio and joining us from the Kaiser Family Foundation studios in Washington, D.C., Julie Appleby, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. And we are trying to bring some clarity to the Affordable Care Act's health insurance exchanges about to open tomorrow, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me see what Anita from Malvern has to say. Anita, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I have two questions. I'm wondering who provides the care if it is obtained through the federal exchange, and also what is the difference between the federal exchange and private exchanges? So those are two questions.
Fair enough. Julie, can I toss those to you?
Sure. Who provides the care will be the doctors and hospitals in the region where you live. So you're just going through a federal or a state marketplace to purchase the insurance. Then the insurance is provided by local doctors and hospitals, that type of thing. And the other question is, what is the difference between the federal
exchange?
The federal exchanges and the state exchanges. Well, the federal exchanges are going to be operating in about 36 states, and the other states are either going to be doing the other states are going to be doing their own. So in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, for example, they've opted to have the federal government entirely oversee theirs. And in Delaware, they're doing a partnership with the federal government. For many consumers, they may not see a whole lot of difference in the website and the interface. But the big difference is going to be in the outreach and enrollment efforts. There is a lot less money for the states that are in the federal exchange to do enrollment and outreach. There's a lot more money for the states who are doing their own. So I think you're going to see more campaign and advertising enrollment. And they, in the end, some folks are saying that those states may well see much higher enrollment than the states with the federal exchange, which could impact the whole effort in those states.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I guess the kiosk thing that you were mentioning earlier, Rob.
But to the caller's question, you as a consumer won't see any difference. You'll go to a website or call a toll-free number, and it will be specific to your state. And unless you're really discerning about these kinds of details, you won't really know whether it's federally run or state run. You also asked about private exchanges, and I'm not sure if you meant state exchanges by that, but there is a creature called a private exchange, which an employer or group of employers can set up for their own workers, which is separate from these government-run exchanges, and it allows the workers to have the same idea of a menu of different options. And Walgreens just announced a couple of weeks ago that it would put its workers into one of those exchanges. So that is yet another option that will possibly change what people with employment-based coverage can get.
And Julie, the website I've seen is healthcare.gov. Is that the sort of go-to website for this program?
Yes, people can go to healthcare.gov and they can go on there and find out what their state is doing. And if they are in a state that's doing their own, there'd be a link to the state where they could go to the state website.
I was looking at, again, going back to Kaiser Health, polling over the weekend, finding this is misinformation, that this is a government-run program. It's not. The issue of death panels came up again. Can you speak to that or put that to rest, Julie?
You know, that appears to people still think that there's death panels in there. There are not. That was something that came up a couple of years ago. The idea that prompted it is that the program would have allowed doctors to get paid for talking with people about end-of-life wishes, and that somehow got translated into that there's going to be a death panel. But there is definitely no death panel. Another piece of misinformation that I've seen making the rounds is that there's some email that goes around. It says cancer care will be cut off for people at age 76. Well, there's nothing in the law about that either. That's just another example of things get out there on the internet and take on a life of their own.
Yeah, and that's a problem, Robert.
It's very hard to refute rumors like that in the public eye. It's sort of the swift boating of healthcare. And research shows that you don't do it by repeating it and saying, oh, it's not true, because then you almost give it credibility by repeating it. What you do is you shift the conversation and talk about how this law will help people without coverage, will make it more affordable for poor people, and so forth. It is a delicate job. It's not such an easy job, but it can be done. The rumors won't disappear completely because there are people who want to believe them. So you're always going to have that problem. But I think that if you emphasize the positive side of the law, you will distract public attention from them.
And we're almost up at a break here, but does it make sense, Robert, just to repeat it over and over and over and over and over again?
You know, how many times do you see an ad for Coke every day? On billboards, on TV and radio, in the printed press and so forth. They've been doing that for about 120 years. Does it work? You tell me.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation and our callers. We are talking about the health insurance exchanges, the Affordable Care Act, and we are taking calls, just a couple open lines, at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Julie Appleby and Robert Field, our guests. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you a woman age 40 to 65? Are you worried about weight gain, heart health, or symptoms of menopause? Drexel University is offering a research program designed to help midlife women have a healthier lifestyle. Through group meetings with other women, this program is designed to help women increase exercise, improve eating habits, and manage stress and mood. More information at 215-553-7110 or email nextsteps@drexel.edu. Drexel supports WHYY.
In the United States, an estimated 5 million children experience domestic violence. Most victims suffer quietly, but there's good reason to speak out.
We decided to raise awareness and put ourselves out there, and when we did, it actually helped us understand what we went through.
On the next Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, helping children exposed to domestic violence. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Yefim Bruffman joins the Philadelphia Orchestra for the music of Beethoven, the Piano Concerto No. 4, and Semyon Bishkov conducts the 11th Symphony of Shostakovich, the year 1905. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or online. October 10th, 11th, and 12th at the Kimmel Center, Yefim Bruffman plays Beethoven with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Drexel University's Robert Field and Julie Appleby, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Let me see what Don from Abington has to say. Don, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. I'm currently unemployed, and I'm very excited about the idea of these getting health insurance through these exchanges. But nothing I've heard talked about, I've seen the classifications of plans being bronze, silver, gold, platinum.
Right.
But to me, a big part of choosing a health care plan is whether their network is like and whether my doctors are in network and out of network. And I've heard nobody talk about that.
Well,
and that's a big, important point.
Indeed. Well, I'm glad you raised it, Don. And Julie, I'm going to toss that first to you and then to you, Robert Field.
That's because the information generally is not out there yet. I think we're going to have to wait till October 1st and then log in and then look on each individual insurer's site to look at the network. And that is one of the big questions that people have. How broad will this be? The concern that consumer advocates have is that people will sign up for plans that have a very small network and will need some kind of specialty care that's not covered in their network or is not available. There's maybe only one doctor and he's 100 miles away or something like that. And so they're very concerned about this and that people would then face higher costs because they may have to go to an out-of-network provider. Now, not all narrow networks are necessarily going to be bad networks. I spoke with an analyst the other day who pointed out that some of the more successful HMOs and other things like that limit you to where you can go. You're limited to go to their doctors, but they still have high quality ratings and high satisfaction ratings. So networks are an important piece of this, and people are going to need to go on and look when they're selecting a plan. What's included in there? What's my doctor? And this also goes to the point that many consumer advocates are making, that there's not a huge rush to sign up right away. And in fact, you might be better off to look at what's available in your area, call your doctor, call the specialist you'd like to see in your network, see if they're participating in this plan, and take a little while to make a choice before you select one.
And Robert Field, I noticed that the White House and others are saying, look, not everything is going to be up and running on this first day. I believe you have 6 months in order to sign up, and it might make sense to wait a couple of days before going ahead.
Absolutely. What website works on day one? Amazon didn't work as well on day one as it does today. So I would urge people not to visit the exchange sites tomorrow. If you want your coverage to be effective January 1st, you have between tomorrow and December 15th to sign up for it. So that means if you wait until November, that's a full month to get some of the kinks out. If you are simply concerned about the mandate, you have until March 31st to sign up. So there really is no rush. You have time to see what's out there, to do your research. There's a chance, and partly this is wishful thinking, that the Philadelphia area will have less of an issue with restricted networks than other areas, because in this area there are only two major HMOs, and essentially every doctor accepts both of them. But that's still going to be something to look at, and that may be the single most important aspect of your choice.
Let me see what John from Pensauken has to say. And John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I've done a lot of research online. I have an uninsured 20-year-old son, and as near as I can tell, there's a bit of a donut hole in that he's not over 18, in that I'm on Medicare. I do not have family insurance that he can jump into. So the option of putting on that until he's 26 is negligible. And he's also younger than 21, which I understand is when he is eligible to get all this insurance on his own. I'm wondering if you can see if I'm reading this right, if you can give me some confidence that there may be some options for him, short of waiting until he's 21 years old.
Well, John, we'll do our best. I'm looking at you, Robert Field, with a slightly quizzical look on your face.
Yeah, maybe Julie can jump in, but I'm not aware of a 21-year-old limit. I think he can go to an exchange. And in fact, up until the age of 30, he can get a high-deductible policy, which will probably be very cheap, and with the subsidies will be even cheaper. So I don't think he's really got a problem.
Do you see a problem, Julie?
And I'm just looking at a chart right here that shows individual plans for children 0 to 20 years and then individual plan for 21-year-olds. So it might just be how they've structured the pricing, but he should be able to go to the exchange and buy a policy and may even qualify for some assistance in purchasing that.
Thanks for the call, John. Let me see what Sean from Mount Airy has to say. And Sean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I was wondering if transgender surgeries might start being covered under the Affordable Care Act.
Are they covered under the pre-Affordable Care Act? Does anyone know?
Very rarely.
It depends on the plan. That's really not going to change. Plans generally cover whatever is considered medically necessary, and they will continue to do that. Now, it may be medically necessary with a limited range of providers, but if it's needed, they will cover it. It's really a decision as to whether that's medically needed.
Thanks, Sean, for the call to Radio Times. Julie, let me just pick on something else that we haven't really talked about, which is that the employer mandate has been delayed for, what, a year, right?
That's correct. So remember, the mandate affects employers with 50 or more workers in the first place, and so they have to offer insurance or they potentially face a fine. That reporting and fine requirement has been delayed till 2015 for those employers that would be affected. And most employers with 50 or more workers, the vast majority of them already offer coverage. So this delays the fine, but many of them were not expected to face it this year anyway.
So it's a small group of companies, I guess, that are trying to figure out whether they're going to provide this kind of care for their employers or employees,
well,
I should say.
Employers have always had the option. It's always been voluntary to offer health insurance or not. So I think they're all weighing whether they want to continue, how that's going to keep going. Most of the polling that I have seen indicates that most employers do not plan on dropping coverage for their active full-time employees. The big debate right now, of course, is over what constitutes an employee. The law says it's a 30-hour week work week. People who work 30 hours or more would be considered to be an employee that would need coverage under this. And there's a lot of debate about whether the 30-hour mark is the correct time.
There's also debate as to whether the 50-employee mark is the right one. It's kind of an arbitrary cliff. If you're smaller than that, you don't have to provide coverage. And if you do, you get a subsidy. If you're larger than that, you now have to provide coverage without a subsidy. The delay will mostly affect companies between 50 and maybe 200 employees. Above that, 98% of companies provide coverage and will continue to do so.
Let me toss something back to you, Robert Field. And this was the House vote over the weekend to essentially delay for a year the funding for the Affordable Care Act. This, of course, is this hot potato that's being passed around in Washington.
Right. I think it's even broader than that, is the full implementation of it. And it seems like it's sort of a compromise, but the political ramifications could be very severe. If this is delayed for a year, that's another year for the opponents to try to pick it apart, and that means we'll be bumping up against the 2014 elections, and this will be a huge issue coming a month before we vote. If it goes into effect now, a year from now, the kinks will probably have been worked out. 7 million or many millions of people will be getting their coverage through the exchanges, and the dynamic may shift, and it then will become the Democrats' issue to say, see, we've done it.
Well, Julie, since you're down in Washington, and I know you're a reporter, but is the Affordable Care Act, is that just all, and I guess government shutdown and all these other issues, is that all that Washington is consumed with these days?
It sure seems like it. That is the talk of the day. It doesn't look like the Senate is going to – certainly they will not send the bill back to the House with any kind of a delay. Right. The big question is whether there will be any debate at all over the medical device tax, because another thing that the House did say is that they wanted to strip out this device tax. And this is a 2.3% tax on the sales of certain medical devices, things like defibrillators, pacemakers, things like that, over – a period of 10 years, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that this would bring in $29 billion, and that's part of the taxes and fees that are helping pay for the health care loss. So we'll see what happens with that. There have been some indications that there may be willing to be some compromise on that device tax.
Anything you want to add to that?
That would be an easy compromise because it wouldn't undermine the law. So it's something the Democrats could agree to. $29 billion added to the cost isn't good. On the other hand, it does – in the grand scheme of things, this is a trillion-dollar law. So it wouldn't make that much of a difference. So maybe that's the escape valve that they'll have.
A billion here, a billion there, right?
Right. Eventually adds up.
It does. But that's let me see what Frank from Cherry Hill has to say. Frank, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, Monty, great show.
Thank you.
I have a question. My employer has coverage through Aetna and United Health, and they just recently announced that they're opening it up to the exchanges as well. And a lot of times these companies don't particularly provide such great claim service. Things go unpaid. They say something's not covered. And one of the things that an employer can do is, you know, hold these companies accountable to process the claims right. What's the plan for doing that with these exchanges?
The individual exchange, Frank?
So, you know, all these exchanges are all these little underwriters who are going to be writing coverage. If these guys take everybody's money but don't pay claims right, and by the way, I'm a huge longtime Democrat, huge supporter of the Affordable Care Act, not ashamed to call it Obamacare, but my, you know, as a guy who's covered now with an actual insurance company, I'm not sure what leverage either my employer would have or would care to have, or we as consumers would have if these underwriters don't process claims properly.
No,
it's a big issue in today's world, too.
Indeed. And, Frank, it's a very good question. Go ahead.
The hope is that the exchanges will do that. And perhaps they'll be even more effective than the employers because they'll have a lot more customers and therefore a lot more leverage. But you're right. You won't have your employer right there down the hall to do the arguing for you.
Julie, you want to add to that?
And I believe that over time they're going to post some information about quality of these plans. And some of that information may include, well, how quickly do they process a claim? What is the customer experience? So over time there will be some more indication for consumers, and they'll shop with their feet. And the theory is that people will select plans that are better all the way around.
Frank, thanks for the call. Let me see what looks like Mary from Bensalem has to say. Mary, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was just wondering if you foresee any changes at all with group plans as it relates to the retirees in a particular group. I'm thinking of a group that's over 50 employees. Do you think that's going to be changing somewhere down the road?
You're talking about retirees who are over 50?
The retirees who are now in companies of over 50 employees. Do you foresee that changing, or will the groups still be part of the, their employer coverage, or will they be open up to these Affordable Care plans?
I'm not sure I quite understand the question, but
that will, I think, depend on the employer, and it will also depend on whether you're 65 and above and therefore eligible for Medicare, and that will not go through the exchanges. But there's been a trend for the last 20 years or so of employers cutting back retiree coverage because it just gets more and more and more expensive. So that's independent of health reform, and I think that will be going on regardless.
Julie, and just to underscore what Robert Field just said, which is this, if we're talking about the Affordable Care Act, that has nothing to do with Medicare. Do I have that correct?
That is correct. If you're on Medicare, you are considered to have coverage, and you're not going to face the penalty. You don't have to sign up through the exchanges. You don't have to do anything, basically.
Anything you want to add to that, Robert?
Except for the advantages. Medicare will get a little bit better because the infamous donut hole for prescription coverage will be closed. You'll get better preventive care. But on the whole, you'll get your Medicare supplement, your prescription drug coverage, all of those private add-ons, as you have in the past, not through an exchange. And basic Medicare, you'll get the same as always.
Let me see what Sally from Coatesville has to say. Sally, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi,
this is my question. I'm an old lady over 70. I live on $1,100 a month. The state pays for my Part B Medicare, so I have a 20% gap in paying my medical bills. Is there some way that I can get into an exchange or get some help in paying that last 20%?
Yeah, and, well, only because you're – I'm looking at you, Robert Field. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think in Pennsylvania you should be eligible for Medicaid as it exists now, regardless of whether the state expands it, and that would cover those deductibles. Have you applied for Medicaid? Have you looked into that?
Medicaid?
Medicaid.
Yes. Have you looked into that, Sally? We seem to have lost her. But if she's living on $1,100 a month, it seems...
Yeah, she should be below the poverty level and come within one of the existing categories to be covered.
Julie, looking ahead, and again, assuming things kick into gear over time, are there enough healthcare providers, primary care physicians, nurse practitioners, all the health people that you need in order to have a system that can incorporate what millions of more potential patients or certainly consumers?
That is certainly something we're hearing about. It's a big concern. Will there be enough primary care providers? And I think what we're hearing is that there will be a lot more folks using nurse practitioners, advanced practice nurse practitioners and physician assistants, things like that, either in their own doctor's office or perhaps even going to see a nurse practitioner who has set up her own office or his own office and is doing primary care. So I think there will be a shift to that, but concerns have been raised about will there be enough primary care. Some of these doctors are already stretched. What's going to happen when more and more people get insurance coverage?
Yeah, we do have experience with that. In Massachusetts, where a similar plan was put into effect, there was a crunch for primary care, and there were longer waiting lines, and people did start to use nurse practitioners and others. Over time, that crunch eased out, and the expectation is the same thing will happen here. Right. There probably will be a crunch for primary care during 2014, 2015. It'll take a few years, but the law actually has provisions to train more allied health professionals.
What will you be looking for? I guess over the, let's say, the next 6 months, what will you be looking for as this system rolls out?
Well, number one, do they get the computer systems working? And I know they won't tomorrow, but by December, that's going to be important, because if they're still not functional, then they really do have a problem. Right. Then it's not just a glitch. Then how many people sign up and what the distribution is? Are they getting, as Julie said, those young, healthy people to balance out the sicker people?
Well, on that note, my thanks to you, Robert Field, for joining us today on Radio Times from Drexel University and author of a forthcoming book called Mother of Invention, How the Government Created Free Market Healthcare. And Julie Appleby, thank you very much as well. And she's senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and she joined us from their studios. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, email, and the archives. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us, though. We'll be right back.